ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय तथस्तद् अनुभावेन भुवनात्राय विश्रुतम् कीर्तिं दिक्षु विधन्वाना सरेजा उदराद इव When Bali Maharaj performed these sacrifices, he gained a great reputation in all directions throughout the three worlds. Thus he shone in his position like the brilliant moon in the sky. Bubuje cha sriyam svridham dvija devo palambutam krita krityam ivatmanam manyamano mahamana. Because of the favor of the Brahmins, the great soul, Bali Maharaj, thinking himself very satisfied, became very opulent and prosperous and began to enjoy the kingdom. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The Brahmins are called Vijayadeva, and Kshatriyas are generally called Naradeva. The word Deva actually refers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Brahmins guide human society in becoming happy by satisfying Lord Vishnu. And according to their advice, the Kshatriyas, who are called Naradeva, keep law and order so that other people, namely the Vaishyas and Shudras, may properly follow regulative principles. In this way, people are gradually elevated to Krishna consciousness. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 8th canto, 15th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Bali Maharaj Conquers the Heavenly Planets. Because of the favor of the Brahmins, the great soul Bali Maharaj, thinking himself very satisfied, became very opulent and prosperous and began to enjoy the kingdom. We are reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8. Chapter 15, entitled Bali Maharaj Conquers the Heavenly Planets. Text 36. We were discussing yesterday how Bali Maharaj was able to accomplish what he did. The devas had already drunk to their full satisfaction that celestial nectar that was so incredibly precious. It was so precious that two bitter enemies, enemies for countless generations, the Asuras and the Devas, who never get along on any issue, they were actually willing to work together as allies because there was no other way of getting that nectar. Now, we are little humans crawling around in this earth planet. But when we're speaking about these Asura race, the Daityas and the Devas, they are extremely powerful, with extremely long lives, and greatly learned. And this is how much they valued this pot of nectar. They were willing to risk their lives, work harder than they ever worked before, hand in hand with their worst enemies, because they considered this so valuable. Because it gave such strength, longevity, wisdom, power. And eventually, by the grace of the Lord, despite so many reversals, obstacles, and impersonal, impossible situations, the Devas got all of it. And they conquered the Asuras. In fact, they killed Bali Maharaj. But Shukracharya, a descendant of the Bhrigu dynasty, brought Bali back to life. And Bali felt so grateful that he did everything within his power to please the Brahmins, saintly people, the descendants of Bhrigu. And because he received their blessings, Brahma Tejas, he had so much power that even the strength that the nectar provided the demigods could not stand before him. And Bali Maharaj, he was so empowered. Can you imagine? Just by looking at him, just by seeing Bali, he was so effulgent with potency that Indra and all the devatas disguised themselves and ran away and left all their hard-earned property. Now, please understand, to get the property of Indra, it's not like you get a job and you work and you get something. Lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes more of performing yajñas and tapasyas and austerities. Controlling your senses, living extremely pious, performing 100 asvamedha yajñas, which are impossible for anyone to even do one properly unless you conquer all directions. That takes many, many lifetimes in order to get that position. And to leave it all behind and run away so that your enemy will just take it and enjoy it all. That was Bali Maharaj's power. Just by seeing him, his enthusiasm. And how did he get it? It's explained here. Because with a very, very good heart, he pleased great souls and received their blessings. So in material society, culture is very much about respect and receiving blessings. In the Indian culture, when I came from the West, coming from the 1960s, where there was a war between the two generations. The young generation of those in their teens and 20s were having a cultural revolution against the older generation. And when I come to India and I entered into the homes of cultured families, I would see every morning that children would touch the feet of their parents and bow down and ask for blessings. Not just as a formality, but they were really asking for blessings. And the parents were giving heartfelt blessings before they went to school, before they went to work, before they went to play. There's a certain power and protection in receiving blessings from good people. And when those blessings are coming from spiritually evolved people, then it has a very special potency. Because those who are saintly or spiritually evolved, they've taken shelter of the power of God. And the greatest power of God is grace. Grace is sweet. Grace is gentle. But it's more powerful than the wrath of God. The wrath of God can destroy planets or universes or punish people. Even the greatest rulers can be brought down to their knees. But the grace of God could lift one up, even from a very fallen, miserable situation, or from a very elevated situation. Could actually lift one up and give one entrance into the realm of eternity. Apare yamitashvanyam prakritim vidimeva jiva bhuta mahabaho. Krishna tells in Gita that there are eight material elements: earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and ahankar or ego. Many subdivisions of these. But above and beyond that is another nature, the spiritual nature, which is the Atma, the soul, the Jiva, that gives power and life. This body is like a vehicle. Just as we see through the windshield of our car, we see through our eyes. Just as we make noise through the horn, we make noise through our tongue. We hear through our ears, feel through our skin, think through our brain, smell through our nose. But who is it that's experiencing? The body is just matter. Matter is not conscious, but it is that spiritual nature, that spiritual force. Prabhupada calls it the living force, which is the Atma or the soul, which animates and experiences through this body. And how to realize in our present condition, since time immemorial, due to the ego, the ahankar, the soul is in a dream state thinking that I am this mind and I am this body, and we're forgetful of our own eternal nature. And we think when the body's dead, I'm dead. And when the body's in pain, I'm in pain. And we forget the love for God that is within us, and the unlimited ecstasy of that love We're trying to find it somewhere because it's our nature. It's our most fundamental need to find unlimited love and to love unlimitedly. We're searching for it, we're groping for it, and whatever we could find that gives us some pleasure, that gives a semblance to that, we attach ourselves to those things. And different people look for it in different ways. The power of grace can destroy illusion, can destroy ignorance, and awaken the true glory of the self. Reveal the inner ecstasy and reveal our relationship with God and reveal our relationship, our true relationship with all beings. Where there is love for God, there is natural, spontaneous compassion for every living being. It cannot be otherwise. Otherwise, that love is not awakened. So this is the power of God's grace. It can liberate us forever and bring us to the highest platform of eternal love and eternal fulfillment. So the saintly persons who are connected to that grace of God, having taken shelter of the Supreme Lord, that's what they have to give to the world. That's what they want to give to the world. But we have to be willing to accept it and to access it. Just like the sun wants to give sunlight to everyone, without discrimination of who's fit or unfit. If we hide in a cave, we will not get any of the benefits of the sunlight. We'll have a vitamin D deficiency. We won't see anything either. But if we just go out into the sunlight, we get so many of the benefits of the sunlight. In the same way, through saintly people, God is giving the light of his grace. And that is their blessing. The blessing of great souls is giving Krishna's blessings. And that blessing is beyond the giver. To be an instrument of the unlimited is the most fantastic way of living. There's not all that much fun in doing the best you can according to what you can do. But to do the best you can and access a grace, a power that is far beyond yourself, and seeing that manifesting through you, that has to humble you. You see, when you do something great yourself, you can easily become proud. But when you recognize that it's not me, there's something beyond me happening here, if you actually recognize that, you cannot become proud or arrogant. You become humble. Why me? This is the way the great saints think. Why is this happening through me? And therefore, such personalities, they're always seeking blessings. They're giving blessings without even giving. All they have to do is be pleased with you, and you get all the blessings. Because you cannot demand blessings. when we actually give satisfaction to a great spiritual personality, then through that satisfaction, Krishna or God showers unlimited blessings on you. And if you cause dissatisfaction to great personalities, then just the opposite happens. And God's not very satisfied. He withdraws his mercy. Krishna tells in one beautiful verse, Mad Bhakta Puja Pyadika, that one who serves my devotee is more dear to me than one who serves me. Like a father or a mother. If you do something to please the child, then the parents are much more happy than if you do something for them, because they love the child so much. Or in the West, there is the saying, love me, love my dog. Yeah, because people become very much attached to their dogs. They put so much affection in their dog. If you give them a nice flower and then kick the dog in the face, they'll probably throw the flower in your face. If you give a diamond ring to a mother and then punch her child, is she going to be happy with you? Baby child? No. If you give the diamond ring to the child, she'll probably be happier. Because there's love. So, in this particular verse, Bali Maharaj, he gained such material prosperity simply because he was very eager and anxious to receive blessings. And we find in the future chapters, he's going to get the highest spiritual reward also, because he had that temperament of being very grateful. In order to receive blessings, first of all, blessings comes through the will and the instructions of the great souls. The spirit, the guru, the saints, they are giving instructions in how to live a pious life of good character and devotion to the Lord. And if we accept those instructions and live by them, then we receive the blessings. It's not some supernatural thing where somebody has to come up and touch your head to give you blessings. That touching head stuff is a very cheap blessing. The real blessing is in their words. And when we actually apply their words to our life, and live by that type of pure, humble, and sincerely devotional character, then we are accepting the blessings. And with that blessings comes that unlimited grace, by which one can overcome all obstacles. Whether you are a criminal or a saint, physically you have to die. But death is not an impediment for a person who has been illuminated by those blessings. Why? Because for such a person, consciously we realize that death is a change of clothes, that the soul lives on. And ultimately, our relationships, when we have cultivated spiritual relationship, those relationships live on. when we love a person's eternal soul, of course you can't love a person's eternal soul unless you recognize their soul, and you can't recognize their soul unless you recognize your own soul. But when we're self-realized, then our relationships take on a completely different dimension. They're not limited just to the proximity of these bodies, which are going to vanish at any time and in due course of time. When you're young, sometimes you hear it, but it just doesn't really make any difference because we have so much energy and we think we have so long to live. But little Prahlad was 5 years old, and he was teaching the same idea, Bhagavad Dharma, to his 5-year-old classmates. And they were revealing their minds to Prahlad. Why are you telling us, we're only 5 years old, all this stuff about God and self-realization, this is for old people who are about to die, because they don't really have that much else to look forward to. So, but we have whole lives ahead of us. Prahlad said, Komara achare pragyo dharman bhagavataniha. It's actually for 5-year-old children. It's for everyone, because you don't know if you'll live one more day. There's no guarantee for anyone. We see it, but we don't believe it. A few years ago, right here in the temple, I remember it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and everything started shaking, and the windows were going, and the doors were going, and the gym. At that time, we had our orphanage downstairs, and they were all screaming, but they were screaming Krishna's name, so it was quite sweet. But they were really screaming Krishna's names. Do you remember, Govinda? It wasn't like Krishna, Krishna. They were screaming Krishna's names because there was an earthquake. And the whole building was trembling, shaking, and it was felt like it was on the verge of just collapsing right on our heads. So the brahmacharis, children, everybody was chanting. Krishna was just playing his flute. No problem for him. And it stopped, but just a couple hundred miles away from here, there were 12,000 people killed within a few minutes. And the vast majority of them were young people, housewives, the mothers, put their idli mix together so in the morning they could easily make breakfast. They never were thinking that idli mix would never be used. The children had their plans for the next day of school or play. No one had any conception that they would never wake up. But there were about 15,000 people who never woke up. And a couple years later, the same thing happened in Gujarat, a few hundred miles away. A couple years after that, there was that tsunami. And every day, people fall off trains or get car crashes. So, we don't want to just dwell on these negative things, but we should. They should sober us. Because unless we understand the imminence of death, we never really take advantage of the beauty of life. How precious every moment is. And what real life is about. Accessing that eternal nature, which is beyond birth and beyond death. Which every great spiritual tradition throughout history has been focusing on that, on the consciousness beyond matter. That's the animating force, the real you, the real me. So instructions in how to live in harmony with our true self, that is God's blessing to the world. If a person's sick and you cure them of a disease, even by some miracle, that's not as much a blessing as awakening a person's divine consciousness, because they're going to get sick again and they're going to die. So it's just a temporary measure. When they asked our Gurudev, Prabhupada, can you show me a miracle? Can you make ashes? Can you make gold? Can you make jewelry? Can you cure sick people? Prabhupada was very humble. He said, I have gone to the West and made hippies into happies. In other words, just people who were lost, gave them direct connection to their eternal blissful nature and to God, to Krishna. Raised them above death. That is actually the birthright of every human being. Atato Brahma Jigyasa. That's the greatest purpose of human life. It's the greatest opportunity within human life. And accessing blessings is such an important part of this. Even when the Supreme Lord descends, he teaches by his own example. We read about the greatest saints and the greatest avatars. Jiva Goswami, greatest scholar that ever lived. But yet, he considered himself to be just a humble instrument of his guru, Rupa Goswami's blessing. There's that beautiful story when one proud scholar came to defeat Rupa and Sanatan Goswami in debate and get their signature on a certificate that they were formally defeated by him. And Rupa and Sanatan Goswami said, there's no need to debate with us because you're better than us anyway, so just give us the certificate and we'll sign it. They signed it. They didn't care what people thought. And then he was going around showing everybody. And Jiva Goswami said, they could have defeated you. They're just not arrogant like you. That they want to be famous for being great scholars. They're using their scholarship to understand the truth, not to make themselves prestigious. To defend their name, I will debate you. And he was their nephew and their student, and he debated and he defeated them. He defeated the scholar. And the scholar had to rip up all his signatures and leave. So Rupa Goswami chastised Jiva Goswami. Why you did that? He said, I was trying to defend your name, Guruji. He said, no. He said, you fell into the trap of using your scholarship for your own prestige. Now you have defeated him. And to live in Vrindavan, no one with even a trace of this type of arrogance should live in Vrindavan, so you should leave. Now, he could have just defended himself, but he accepted. Maybe I don't understand what my guru is saying, but it must be good for me. He must be right. Maybe I just don't... He must be seeing on a deeper level that it was due to pride that I did that. And he left. And he started performing tapasya. And eventually Rupa Goswami brought him back when he heard about Sanatana Goswami, and Rupa Goswami brought him back. And Rupa Goswami was so proud of him. He revealed to him the innermost confidential secrets of spiritual truths. Because he saw that his disciple was just so sincere. He had no ulterior motives. And Lord Ram, we read in Ramayana, Ram is the Supreme Lord incarnate in this world. Supreme Lord means Bhagavan, the possessor of all beauty, all knowledge, all strength, all wealth, all fame, and all detachment. That, according to the Vedas, is the definition of God, Bhagavan, the source of everything that exists. Krishna tells in Gita, all beautiful, wonderful things within this world are just a spark of my splendor, like a ray of the sun. So when Ram was living in Ayodhya, the great saint, Vishwamitra, he came to the courtyard, to the court, and the king, now Dasarath, was not just like a political leader of today, he was actually a king. And in those days, long ago, there wasn't elections every 4 years where you had to campaign and you had to make allies with enemy parties just to somehow or other get enough seats so that you can be in your situation. And then you have to compromise with all different types of lobbyists, otherwise they'll withdraw their support and their funding. Yes, today, in those days, a king was a king till he decided to give the kingdom to his son or a queen, whatever. He was a very powerful person, with massive armies, tremendous wealth, and it was for life. Now, usually people who have that type of power, practically absolute power, when you're a king of a massive kingdom, and all the citizens loved him because he ruled with such compassion and he had no ulterior motives. He was really there for them. Because in the Vedic system, everyone is a servant. No one is a master. Only God is master. And even God likes to serve. So everyone's a servant. King means you give your life to serve the subjects you have in your kingdom. And the subjects are serving each other and serving the king. Everyone's serving. The guru is serving the disciples. The disciples are serving the guru. Jivera Swarupoi Krishnara Nityadas. But everyone's in this spirit of service. That's spiritual consciousness. So here is Dasarath Maharaj. He's more than a billionaire. He's the proprietor of everything in his kingdom. And he's sitting on his magnificent throne. And in comes Vishwamitra. Vishwamitra's just wearing tree bark. He has no house. He has no home. He lives in the jungle, sleeping on the ground. No possessions. His only set of clothes is some tree bark around his body. And he comes in, but because he's a saintly person, he has attained the wealth and the power of self-realization. And Dasarath Maharaj understood that as a king, he had attained the wealth and the power of the things of this world, but it didn't compare to what Vishwamitra had. So from his heart, he came down off his throne and put Vishwamitra on his throne and washed his feet. Such a humble position. You know, washing feet is not like if you go to the hospital and you have a cut on your foot, then the doctor will wash your feet. But it's not like that. This is out of, he's not getting paid for it. That's the main thing. He's not doing it to treat Vishwamitra Muni. He's doing it to actually, from his heart. You are great, I am small. And then he asks for Vishwamitra Muni's blessings. He said, whatever I have is only due to the blessings of saintly people. So please give me instructions and give me blessings. Now, the thing about this blessing stuff is you have to be prepared. If you just ask, expecting to get what you want, it may not be like that. So Vishwamitra Muni said, oh, yes, here is my blessing. Give me your son, Ram. Now, for Dasarath, this was worse than death. He loved his son. And for Dasarath, Ram, he may have been the Supreme Lord, but for Dasarath Maharaj, being the Supreme Lord was a detail. The real thing is he's my son. He didn't see him as a Supreme Lord. Due to his parental affection, he was seeing him as a boy who was depending on him, who was still very young. He was only a teenager. And you want to take him into the forest to fight against Rakshasas? Very, very powerful mystical demons. Vishwamitra Muni say, yes, I want to bring him to the forest. These rakshasas, these supernatural, these demons with supernatural powers, they are harassing the saints. So I want your son to come. And Dasarath said, I will come with my whole army, but leave Ram home. Vishwamitra said, I want Ram. I don't want you, and I don't want your armies. And Dasarath tried to talk him out of his blessing. First he asked for a blessing, then he was doing everything within his mental power to talk him out of it. But Vishwamitra Muni was very focused. So eventually, Dasarath was thinking, and some other sages said, Dasarath, you don't want to displease this great personality. Give him Ram. And, you know, he will protect Ram, don't worry. So they left. So Ram, the Supreme Lord, takes the blessings of his father before he goes. And then he takes the blessings of Vishwamitra Muni to go. Then he takes the blessings of his mother to go. And then he goes. And then there's so many stories that happen there. When there actually did happen, that fight took place, Ram received the blessings of Vishwamitra first. And although Ram is the Supreme Lord, he wanted to teach. They came to one forest place where they, for the first time, they saw the river Ganges, the Ganga. And Ram was so enthusiastic. He asked Vishwamitra, please tell me about the history. Tell me about the greatness of the river Ganga. And Vishwamitra Muni, for a long time, he extolled the history and the power and the glories of the sacred river Ganges. And Ram was massaging his guru's feet and doing little services, bringing him wood to start fires to keep warm at night in the forest. And then Vishwamitra Muni led them toward Mithila. Mithila, the kingdom of Janak. And Vishwamitra Muni told Ram and his brother Lakshman that here in this beautiful kingdom, there is an ancient bow. And anyone who could lift and string this bow will get Sita, the princess's hand, in marriage. Ram and Lakshman listened. When they came into the kingdom, Janak Maharaj heard Vishwamitra Muni's come. So he first sent ministers there to greet him. Then Janak himself, that king of that kingdom of Mithila, brought Vishwamitra into his court, put the sage on a throne, washed his feet, honored him, said, "How can I serve you? Please give me your blessings." Vishwamitra said, "I would like to see that bow." "Oh, first he introduced who is Ram and who is Lakshman, the children of Dasarath Maharaj in Ayodhya. And immediately Janak was thinking, if only he could take my daughter Sita in marriage. Actually, Janak told the story of the bow to Vishwamitra. He said, long ago there was a great battle of the Devas and the Asuras, and Lord Shiva personally gave his own bow to the Devas. But there was no need for it at that time. So the Devas handed it down, they gave it to my great forefather. And this bow has been worshipped within our kingdom for many, many generations. Now one day, when I was about to do a sacrifice, a yajna, for the welfare of all my citizens, I was plowing with a golden plowshare the ground around the sacrificial arena, and out from the earth came a beautiful golden girl. Her name is Sita, born of the earth, and she's so beautiful. In fact, Narada Muni told me that she's the goddess of fortune herself. So when she came of age, every great prince, every great king, everyone wanted to marry her. But if she's the goddess of fortune, she fixed her mind only on the Supreme Lord, Vishnu. So I decided to put a test that only a person who could lift this bow and string it will take the hand of Sita in marriage. And I knew only Vishnu, the Supreme Lord, could do it. So king after king, prince after prince, warrior after warrior, everyone is coming. This bow is so heavy that no one is even able to budge it slightly from where it's laying down. Even the mighty Ravana couldn't take it off the table. So Vishwamitra said, "Bring us to see the bow." So the next day, they had 300 huge, strong men pull this iron case into the center of the court of the king. Then they opened the lid, and there was the bow.
It was made out of celestial wood, gold, diamonds, rubies, emeralds, and jewels decorating it. Hundreds of little bells tinkling, but nobody could make it tinkle because nobody could move it. Ready. It was huge. And the word spread throughout all of Mithila that Ram, the prince of Ayodhya, has come and he's going to try to lift the boat. So everyone was praying. Sita was in a balcony in the special room where the bow was kept. And she saw the beauty of Ram from above. She witnessed hundreds and hundreds of other people come to attempt to lift that bow. And every time she prayed to the Lord, don't let him lift it. Because she saw every single one of these kings was arrogant. They were so proud of their powers, of their influence, of their beauty, of their high birth, of their wealth. And she understood that the greatest of all virtues is humility. She didn't want to marry an arrogant person. But when she saw Ram, not only was his physical beauty absolutely charming, but his demeanor, his character. He wouldn't even go toward the bow. Vishwamitra looked at him and nodded, "Ram, I'm blessing you. Go lift that bow." Ram didn't take a step toward it till Vishwamitra gave him the instruction and the blessing. Just see, the Lord would not do it without receiving the blessings of his superiors, his senior. After receiving Vishwamitra's blessing, Ram very slowly walked up to the bow. And Janak Maharaj, his heart was palpitating like, if Ram can't do it, then there's no use in me living anymore. He was the queens, the kings, everyone there was just praying from their heart of hearts, please, Ram, pick up this bow. And Sita, she was watching from the top with tears in her eyes. Her heart was fluttering, praying, pleading, begging, give Ram the power to do it. I've already given my heart, my life, my everything to him. And Ram made everything very dramatic. He stood in front of the bow for some time and looked at it, as all these emotions were happening in everyone's hearts and everyone's minds. Because, you know, they were looking. His hands were so soft, like the petals of a lotus flower. And his arms were so tender and smooth. And the bow was so heavy and coarse and hard. And how is this little prince going to possibly be able to do it? But he has to do it because no one else is qualified to marry Sita. And Sita, her whole life was on the line. She already gave her heart and her soul to Ram. And Janak had already in his heart felt, there's no other man that can marry my daughter. But at the same time, they vowed, that person has to lift the bow and string it. String it means bend it. So Ram stood there looking. The only person who didn't have any agitation in his mind was Vishwamitra Muni. Because Vishwamitra Muni knew the power of Ram. He's the Supreme Lord. Very interesting relationship. Ram asked blessings from Vishwamitra Muni, and Vishwamitra Muni understood that Ram is my Supreme Lord. Whatever blessings I have is only coming from him. It's like the way they worship the Ganges River is you take water from the Ganges and offer it to the Ganges. So Vishwamitra is taking the grace of God and offering it back as a blessing to the Lord. Then Ram put that tender hand in the center of the bowl and just stood still, holding the center of the bowl. Everybody's minds were just soaring with anticipation, unbearable anticipation. And Vishwamitra Muni said, "Lift the bow." Suddenly Ram, very fast, he picked up the bow and with his arm straight, held it over his head. Everyone gasped. It was inconceivable. It was incredible. It was unbelievable. No. Even the greatest, most powerful people in the planet, many of them together, couldn't lift it off the table. And this teenage prince, Ram, just lifted it right over his head effortlessly as a person just picks up a little piece of bamboo. Then he placed one end to the ground, then he took the top end and bended it and put the string and strung the bow. There was absolute, total silence during this whole procedure. And then he already did what he was supposed to do. He strung the bow. But then he wanted to see what this bow is really made out of. So with one hand, he held the bow up. With his other hand, he pulled a string, and he pulled it back, 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 back until it was bent like a semicircle, and then the bow cracked. But it didn't sound like what I just did. It was thunderous. The entire earth shook. The chandeliers in the palace were going like this. And then Sri Ram very gently placed the pieces of the bow back into the chest. Meanwhile, Janak's eyes were filled with tears. It was the happiest moment of his entire life. And Sita on the balcony, she was smiling. She just wanted to jump and start dancing. But she somehow or other had to, because it was a very sober occasion, she remained very still and very shyly looked down as her heart was leaping and jumping and dancing and ultimate ecstasy. But she stood, and Dasar and Janak, he gave her blessings, said, "Sita, come down now." And she came down, and she had the garland of victory. The garland that for years so many people strive for, but nobody could get near it. And Sita stood opposite Ram, and she looked down on the ground, very shy. Then she very slowly, her eyes lifted, beautiful lotus-like eyes. they looked up, and for the first time, the gaze between Sita and Ram, between their eyes, met. And at that moment, they both totally gave their hearts to each other. The relationship, their eternal relationship, was reunited. And they both gave their absolute infinite love to each other through their glance. And Sita then looked down. And Janak Maharaj said, "My beloved Sita, offer the garland of victory to Ram." And she very slowly approached, lifted her arms, and placed that golden garland around Ram's neck. At that moment, everyone in the kingdom of Ayodhya was singing and dancing and praising, and flowers were falling from the heavens upon Sita and Ram. Then Janak Maharaj said to Vishwamitra Muni, "When should we have the marriage?" Vishwamitra Muni said, "Immediately." So they sent messengers to Ayodhya. Took 3 days to reach there. And they came, because in those days it wasn't like internet. Now, you know, people would be watching on satellite TV, you know, the live performance of Ram. But nobody knew about it. 3 days later, the messengers came to King Dasarath in Ayodhya and told him what happened. And he was, and this is the amazing thing. He and his wife were thinking so intensely about who could possibly be a fit wife for Ram. And they just didn't, they couldn't conceive of who would be the proper wife for Ram. And just the day Vishwamitra Muni came, they were just discussing it and talking about it. And what appeared to be the worst possible thing, that Vishwamitra Muni was taking him away. Because even though it appeared to be a reversal in his life, because he reciprocated with the mercy, with the grace, the blessings of this sage, ultimately his innermost desire was fulfilled by Ram leaving. And then all Dasarath said, "Immediately, we will bring our armies, we will bring our ministers, we will all go for the wedding." Took him 5 days to reach there. And Dasarath and Janak, old friends, they sat down together and made all the arrangements for the marriage. And Vishishta Muni was there as the head priest. Should I continue? I'll end real soon because it's becoming late. Vishwamitra Muni looks at Janak and said, "As long as Ram's getting married, his three brothers, Lakshman, Bharat, and Satrughna, they should get married too. In fact, Sita has a sister, Urmila. She could marry Lakshman. And your brother, Kushadvaj, he has two daughters. Mandavi could marry Bharat. And Shrutikirti could marry Satrughna." And as soon as he said that, Janak and Evdi kept saying, "Very good, very good, very good, very good." Again and again, "Very good, very good, very good." So Dasarath comes to Satrughna and Bharat and Lakshman, "Would you like to get married?" "Very good, very good." So there was a beautiful, they made a tent for this event. It was a magnificent, opulently decorated tent. It was square, 4 miles across. These are the days where kings were kings. They could do these things. It wasn't like the pundles that we use. It's gorgeous, more beautiful than a palace itself. And the marriage took place where Janak and Kushadvaj performed the Danyakan, Kanyadan. Kanya? Sannyasis don't know these. And thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So the of great personalities, blessings of our parents, blessings of the saints, blessings of the Brahmins, blessings of gurus. It is a very, very sacred part of the culture of spirituality. Thank you very much. Is there any questions? Does anyone have a question? Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you, Maharaj, for a wonderful class. I have a question about blessings. Should we aspire to have the blessings also of those who are not necessarily qualified or even demoniac, if our parents or our relatives are not so favorable to Krishna consciousness? Should we aspire to have their blessings also?
Yes, we should be looking for blessings everywhere.
Their blessing is you don't go to, don't practice Krishna consciousness.
Why are you asking this question? It's very obvious. We want blessings from our parents, but at the same time, we have our path. Since I've been on this path, my parents have given me millions of times more blessings than before. Yes? So we should always be eager, but at the same time, we have the path of truth should be followed. Is there any other questions? After all, parents raise you. Parents have given you so much. We have a debt to them. Yes?
Maharaj, this pastime of Bali Maharaj seems a little mysterious, bewildering, and a little confusing in spite of the purports clarifying. In terms of few things like we were discussing the other day, a few days back, about the first thing is when Bali Maharaj performed this Vishwajit Yajna and he was going to conquer Indra, one of the persons who offered him his blessings is Prahlad Maharaj. and he offered him a garland of flowers that don't fade. And he's going to fight with the devotees, the demigods. And the brahmanas, others who are giving him a worship, who are blessing him, to go and fight against the demigods. So the question that was asked was, you know, like, are they really brahmanas? And how could Prahlad Maharaj also give his blessings? And was Bali actually a Mahajan, or he became Mahajan at that particular instance? Was he a great person before, or?
He became a Mahajan when he did Atmanivedanam. But we should understand that Prahlad could understand the will of the Lord of what was going to happen. So it's a mystery, but we can understand that these great souls, they could see into what was actually going to transpire. By Prahlad wasn't giving him this blessing for the purpose of winning a war. It may appear that, but actually Prahlad doesn't care about those things. Prahlad was giving the blessing of getting the shelter of the Supreme Lord and attaining the perfection of spiritual life. That was Prahlad's blessing. And because he got the blessing of Prahlad, look what happened. He got the opportunity to attain that perfection, and he took it. Yes? Prahlad's blessing is very powerful. Blessing of a pure devotee. It opened the doors for Bali Maharaj to attain the highest perfection. And when Vamanadeva came to beg from Bali, it's a complicated story that would take a couple hours to tell, but when Vamana came, it wasn't just because Aditi performed the Paya Vrata for her children. It was also because Prahlad Maharaj was praying for his grandson to get pure devotional service. And Bali Maharaj was humbling himself to receive Prahlad's prayer, blessings. So it's actually a very, very deep story. We can't just see these in a superficial way. Does that answer your question? Prahlad gave his blessings, and the immediate thing that happened is Bali Maharaj conquered. But if he didn't conquer, there would be no reason for Vamanadeva to take everything away. So really what Prahlad was blessing him for was to ultimately to go through whatever he had to go through to get the Supreme Lord's grace. And how much the Lord hears the prayers of someone like Prahlad. Even Hiranyakashipu was liberated. What to speak of Bali, who was actually a very great soul, always. Is there one more question? Yes, Vrishabhanu Prabhu.
Maharaj, oftentimes we receive respect and we sometimes also offer respect to others. But how to ensure that it never becomes a ritual but a heartfelt, true spiritual activity? Otherwise, many times we see that kind of a mechanically it is done. But how to see that every time we offer respect, it is not a ritual but something endowed with the spirituality and love of the heart?
That genuineness
develops according to our own realizations. So certainly we should consciously, whatever we do on the path of bhakti, it should be from our heart. It shouldn't simply be a mechanical thing. And through developing deeper realizations within, from within ourselves, then whatever we do, whatever we say, will come from that place, where there's very, very deep, sublime feeling. And essentially, unless we have a grateful heart, we can't really be respectful from the heart. Gratitude is all important. Otherwise, respect is just a mechanical formality. But if we're actually grateful, and to be grateful, you have to be humble. If you think, I deserve so much, then you're not grateful for anything that happens. You may go through the formalities of thank you, but are you really thankful? If you just eat a massive feast and someone comes and gives you some food, are you? You're not that grateful. But if you're starving and someone gives you some food, you're really grateful. So if we have an arrogant disposition, then people will give us and we'll say thank you, maybe. We may say thank you, we may not, as a formality, but we're not really grateful. We don't really mean it. But when we have a humble disposition, we're really grateful, not only for the good things, but even for the reversals and the difficulties. Because we see in every situation there's an opportunity to grow. There's an opportunity to learn. There's opportunity for wisdom. There's an opportunity to turn to God and take shelter, even in the difficult times, as well as the good times. So a grateful heart sees an opportunity in every situation, a humble heart, and is grateful for that, and is actually thankful. So even if we're following a spiritual path, and even if our parents may not agree, we're still grateful to them. We're still thankful to them. We may be following a higher principle, but still there's love, and there's gratitude, and there's thankfulness. Yes? What to speak of others? Srila Prabhupada, even when drug addicts on the street, laying on the street in the Bowery, would open a door for him, from his heart of hearts, he would say, thank you. And he meant it. He was thankful to them because they did something for him. They helped him in his service to God by opening that door. He was probably more thankful to those drug addicts and prostitutes who were sleeping in the streets of the Bowery who opened a door for him. He was probably more thankful from his heart to them than when saints give us wonderful things for us, because he had that humility. And he could access God's blessings even in those situations, because he had a grateful heart. Now, how to achieve that? First, we need to want it. And then we cultivate it through our actions, through our words. And most of all, we access it through cleansing our own hearts by making that spiritual connection within ourselves. And in this age of Kali, the most direct way of making that spiritual connection is chanting the names of God. that help to answer your question? Even if it's kind of for, a machine doesn't have a motivation. Yes? So even if we don't have realization, if we're respectful because we really want the realization, because we want to please people, because we want to enrich ourselves, and we want to show compassion and actually honor other people. If we have that desire, then it's not mechanical. Just like any ritual. If you're just performing a ritual without a serious spiritual intention, then it's nothing but a mechanical ritual. But if you're performing that same ritual as an expression of our desire to love God, to purify our own consciousness, then it's not mechanical, because machines can't think like that. It shouldn't be mindless, it should be mindful. And this is the way we should chant God's names as well. Thank you very much.